You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. It is November 13th, 2019. And as always, I want to thank my supporters and donors. And of course, I always desperately need financial assistance from my listeners and those who have learned from me. And that money goes only to one thing. And my record does speak volumes. My predictions tend to come true. I wrote the first 9/11 revisionist essay the very day it happened. I was the first to speak of Putin as a nationalist in Russia as a bulwark against New World Order, at least in English. I was the first back in 91 to show how Hafez al-Assad was an ally of the nationalist movement. I'm the only scholar to write an extended defense of the nationalist and anti-communist military governments in Latin America. I was the first to see the importance of the civil war in Burma. I was the very first to make fun of the ISIS charade. I brought orthodoxy into the mainstream of nationalism, at least in English. I am, in recent memory, the first to bring out the Greek background of Christ and where he was born and raised. I've shown that National Socialism is everywhere in the Third World, in the post-colonial government. From the nationalist point of view, I'm the first to expose the corruption in the U.S. military. And I've brought some obscure but brilliant Russian and Ukrainian nationalists to the forefront. And importantly, I'm the first to see and to note that we need a new political vocabulary to talk about a regime that now blurs the distinction between private and public sources of power. And I say this only to let you know this is what I've done just fairly recently, and where your money goes. This is a full-time job, and this is a nonstop 12-hour a day at least battle with no vacations and no time off. So I thank everyone who's assisted me. You know who you are. And I appreciate everything that you've done for me. Now, the Taliban in Afghanistan, as many of you know, I've defended them in the past as the only legitimate government in Afghanistan. Not that I'm supporting Islam by any means, but as far as that country right now is concerned, they are the legitimate state, because warfare, especially extended warfare, destroys the morality of a people. There is not a single family in that country that hasn't lost numerous people. Warfare destroys morality because life is cheap. The only thing that ever matters is being devious and outsmarting your opponents. The old traditional bonds that tie people together are destroyed because entire villages and areas are destroyed. Therefore, any government that takes over there has to be harsh and has to be very, very strict. To think that you can impose liberal democracy on a country that suffered endless traumas and warfare since the late 70s, almost without interruption, well, you'd have to be an American to believe something so idiotic. And it just, you know, the establishment intellectuals, you know, there's always a price that comes with that money and exposure. Let me give you an example. I mean, back in 2010, and I've mentioned this on paper before. Back in 2010, a Taliban commander began entering negotiations with the U.S. and the Afghan government, which is a puppet of the U.S. He was even given a substantial amount of money to remain at the negotiating table. He claimed to be Mullah Mansour, who the West claims is the second in command of the Taliban. The problem with this was that the man was completely an imposter. He wasn't anybody. In fact, they're not even entirely sure who he was. They were completely fooled. And in fact, the New York Times asks how can they know that it wasn't him if they know that little? And an official in the Afghan government, in the American established Afghan government, said, "The Taliban are more clever than the Americans and our own intelligence service. They're playing games." This ruse lasted for weeks. And you had article after article on this fake Taliban commander. They're talking about, they're analyzing what he says. And of course, the man was a complete imposter. Now, that was in 2010. And what does that tell us? It tells us that after almost a decade, the U.S. has no idea who the Taliban are or what they're about. You have book after book published on these guys, paper after paper after paper, and apparently they don't know who's in command of it. How can the U.S., anything the U.S. says on this organization, be trusted? It tells us that American intelligence in that country is a joke, and it's probably part of the reason why the U.S. has lost the war so badly. But even after being fooled, the U.S. is begging the guy to come back so he could be verified, and I guess thrown in prison. But they still have a small inkling that it actually might be the right guy. But this is the level of knowledge the U.S. has on the ground, and that's after a decade of intelligence, almost a decade of intelligence gathering in the area. Now, 9/11 events were a watershed in American history, as we all know. And it was based on the premise that Osama bin Laden masterminded the 9/11 attacks. Now, that's been refuted over and over and over again from sources all over the political spectrum, mainstream and otherwise. But if you remember, George Bush made the claim that the Taliban had some control over Osama, that he had bases in Afghanistan, that they were working together, and threatened them, "If you don't hand him over, we're going to attack." And that's problematic to begin with. Because why wouldn't they, if they had any control over this man, and it implies that they had control over this man, why would they risk a massive invasion rather than hand him over? Especially since they were opponents. Well, they're both Sunni, that's true, but they were opponents. They were rivals. And the implication that Osama, who had just masterminded this massive operation, was under the control of this relatively new government hanging on to power in the country, shows you just, again, it just shows you how little anyone knows, or at least elites know about the country. The entire premise of all of this, I mean, that just that one small aspect of this story, Bush threatens them to hand him over as if he's in jail in a Kabul prison somewhere. And then, I mean, there's so many things here, but the tape that appeared showing Osama, right when the kind of revisionist movement started to get going, this tape appears, purporting to be prior to the attack, where he's talking about the attack is going to happen in the future, as if he would record something like this, if in fact he would have anything to do with it. Even though, of all the groups operating in that area, he was the only one that didn't take responsibility for it. Well, largely because he was in the hospital in Pakistan. The actor playing Osama was right-handed. Of course, Osama was a lefty. And he was way too heavy. And there was all kinds of computer analyses. But even just by watching it, it was a fake and it wasn't a very good one. He looked vaguely like him. But at the time, no one really knew much, so they could get away with anything. And the funniest part of that is, well, the false quotes from the Quran he was using. So someone who wrote the script there didn't even know that much. So this is what's driving policy. The Taliban came under attack by the U.S. They weren't in power long enough to have an air force, and they evacuated the capital city. And they evacuated it not because they were defeated necessarily, but because they wanted to then engage in a guerrilla war, which they've won. Donald Trump, I mean, they're back on the front page now because Donald Trump has cut off the surrender negotiations with them. If you remember, George Bush said we'll never negotiate with them. After having negotiated with them in the past. But now here's the U.S., ground down in this war of attrition, trying to figure out a way to get out without fully admitting defeat. These are surrender negotiations. And if you also remember, George Bush in 2004, he also said it in 2002, that the Taliban were destroyed, completely eliminated. The government in Kabul or Kabul, depending on what part of the planet you live, has absolutely no legitimacy. The army is a joke. No one trusts them. They're a Western, very wealthy group of guys. The New York Times, again, not the most reliable source of news, but they say this, on October 5th. The meeting in recent days in Pakistan's capital between Taliban officials and the American diplomat Khalilzad came after a surge in bloodshed. The Taliban had spent days concentrating attacks across the country before last week's Afghan presidential election in an effort to derail the electoral process and keep voters from the polls. Well, that wasn't the purpose, of course. The offensive was to retake the country. Now, the elections are a scam, partially because they're being financed and controlled by the occupation government, under American control. Also, they only are taking place in the cities that they control. The majority of the country in the countryside have no, they have no presence there. The U.S. pays for the election, the expenses of the candidates, and directs their policies, which by itself gives the Islamic Emirate, which is the Taliban's real name, even greater legitimacy. So the elections are a complete scam. And even more than that, the polling booths and everything, there was only a handful of them that actually functioned. They were shutting down all the time. And it wasn't because of, there was fraud, but it wasn't just that. It was a lack of technical abilities. And the fact that these were simply just, they had no experience with it. It was going very poorly. The Taliban are correct in condemning these things. The U.S. government has simply refused to talk about its future plans. I mean, it's just the military expenses since 2001 have been about $1 trillion. But it's much higher than that when you have all the ancillary costs. I mean, you have more, a couple of trillion just in VA expenses over the next few years. But the puppet government there couldn't stand for 5 minutes without American aid. And of course, unsurprisingly, they're opposed vehemently to these surrender negotiations. And in fact, they call them surrender negotiations. So the U.S. government in Kabul is saying that the U.S. is surrendering and pulling out because they've been defeated. They know that they wouldn't last very long without American guns there. And when I say last, I mean have control over one or two cities. The Times also stated that General Austin Miller, who was who's the commander of the American mission there, they couldn't say that he was in Islamabad at the time because of the what damage that would do to American morale. The New York Times said it was unclear whether or not he's attended, but he was in the city. So I guess he was in Islamabad as a tourist. So of course he was there. But you can't have American soldiers having a general at surrender negotiations. That would do, and the morale is awful to begin with. So they lie and say that, oh, well, he was there. He was in the building, I guess, but just he wasn't in the room or something ridiculous like that. Now, contrary to myth, this is an aside here, the Taliban do wear uniforms. I've noted this before on my analyses of the Vietnam War and elsewhere. To come under the protection of the laws of war, a guerrilla army, and these rules only were really written in the 70s for guerrillas, they have to wear a uniform of or some identifying feature that you could see at a distance, and they have to have some chain of command and responsibility. Without that, it's just a criminal gang, and the rules of war then don't apply. So for a while, the U.S. was claiming the Taliban didn't wear uniforms, and that's simply not true. They have a Pakistani-made, they were calling, the U.S. media was calling them punk rock uniforms, because it's camouflage pants with a black t-shirt with two pistols. And so they made fun of them. But when you have the Afghan National Army, and then you make fun of someone else, it's absolutely ridiculous. The Afghan National, the only funny thing that's come out of this is the ANA. The Afghan National Army is, and it's unfortunate because these guys are getting killed in huge numbers, but they're, and I have a paper coming out, there's a few YouTube videos on, you know, major, the BBC has one about what these guys are and how the American trainers are giving up. They're so bad. They're usually strung out on heroin or really hashish is their big thing, but they do heroin too. And of course, and another myth on top of that is that they're being trained by Iran. Now, the Taliban are Sunni. It's highly unlikely that that's the case. And of course, the U.S. is trying to tie Iran to anything that they don't particularly care for. Now, but we'll get to the ANA here in a minute. The Afghan government has lost about 45,000 men over the last 5 years. Now, from the Islamic Emirates website, they say this. Some independent media and international observers have reported that the Kabul regime under Ashraf Ghani has lost more than 25% of its force strength and continues to lose an average of 250 soldiers a week. One has to bear in mind that these are conservative estimates because the regime has taken measures to hide the true casualty toll due to the adverse effect it has on the morale of its forces, who are already stretched thin and living in dire conditions. Well, I have more reason to believe the Emirates website than certainly any mainstream American press. The demoralization, the Afghan National Army really is again, it's the only funny thing to come out of this disaster. You have a drug-addicted, illiterate group of guys who joins this army. Of course, it's not exactly good for your reputation to join this occupation army. So they end up getting the lowest. These guys getting kicked out of their and the Americans have admitted this, getting they're in the army because they've been kicked out of their villages for some kind of criminal behavior. The ANA are certainly not capable of dealing with the experienced, disciplined, and well-trained and motivated Taliban organization. And why are the Americans, the few, you know, few thousand that are left, why are they going to put their lives on the line when they're going to be leaving anyway? And the desertion rates in the ANA are extremely high. The U.S. is training both military and police forces, and they're all pretty much the same. They're often high. They have no idea how to use weaponry. They often sell them to the highest bidder. They take apart parts of the base that the U.S., that you, American, and even some European taxpayers pay for and sell it at local markets. And a very unfunny thing is that many American casualties, I'm sure unreported, come from drugged out ANA soldiers firing on them. And the BBC and a few other treatments of the ANA that I've seen online, they have a tendency just to shoot blindly. They don't identify targets. And what was left implicit is that hallucinations have a lot to do with this, both as a result of drugs and a withdrawal from drugs. And the advisors have largely given up on these guys. They often force local kids to fill the sandbags and to do the unpleasant work on military bases. There's been many cases of entire police forces in towns deserting to the Taliban. And they say this on their site. They say the American invaders have poured billions of taxpayer money to prop up the Kabul administration security forces. Yet the current combat operations in Afghanistan continue to be run by Americans due to regime incompetency. The military leadership of Kabul is merely used for media manipulation, while the real reins of this war are with the Americans who run the show behind the curtains. Recently, many American Special Operations Forces personnel have been killed by the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan across Afghanistan, which proves the high level of the American military involvement in the battles against the Mujahideen. Now, the other scandal, of course, is civilian casualties. Given what we know about the level of military intelligence in that part of the world, they use scorched earth tactics. And that's really the only thing that keeps the ANA from being completely slaughtered. But it's also what causes high civilian casualties. So you have, you know, American ambassadors, you know, politicians, bankers, everyone who's bankrolling all this stuff, they show up to an American base or an ANA base, which are the same thing. And you should hear what they're being told. That everything is going fine. The ANA is an elite force. Your money's being well spent. They have a few Potemkin villages around. But this is the foundation of, this is the foundation of American policy and European policy. The Taliban has wiped out entire companies of the ANA in a very brief period of time. Taliban are trained, experienced, and motivated. The ANA has absolutely no motivation whatsoever. And remember, the fatwa that the Taliban leadership issued back in the 90s against all drug use, especially heroin use, is still in effect. But the Mujahideen, or the military force of the Taliban, actually put out proper casualty figures, which I frankly would believe more than American casualty figures. They say in 2016 that they have launched 9,153 small and large attacks against the ANA and other occupation forces. Of those, 32 are what they call martyrdom operations, which I think are suicide attacks. And that they've killed 266 foreign invaders, 135 injured. And they claim that the ANA are essentially used as a shield for these guys. That they have lost, you know, they have 17,539 army, police, intelligence, and local militias, and almost 12,000 wounded. They claim 3,400 different vehicles, APCs, pickup trucks, whatever, have been destroyed, and 28 enemy aircraft, including 14 helicopters, 10 UAVs, two fighters, and two large transports, what they call logistical airplanes. And that's signed by Zabihullah Mujahideen. Now, shooting down aircraft isn't beyond the realm of possibility using the old Stinger missile systems that, of course, they've been using for a very long time. I have no reason to doubt these figures. I mean, they may be slightly exaggerated, but especially since lying is a deadly sin for them. And I certainly would believe them more than the American casualty figures, which, needless to say, don't even remotely match those. That's just 2016. And not even all of 2016. Now, in 2019, when the surrender negotiations began, it was Putin, of course, who offered a forum for the first conference. And the first thing the Taliban said when they got there is that they don't seek exclusive rule, what they said. They said, so long as they're Islamic and not associated with the occupation government, we're willing to work at a consensus level with anyone who wants to work with us. They realize that rebuilding this country is going to be long and expensive, not just physically, but morally too. At the Moscow conference, they said this, their opening speech, they said, the current constitution of the Kabul administration is not reliable because it has been copied from the West and has been imposed on Afghanistan's Muslim society under the shadow of occupation. It can neither respond to the desires of the Afghans, nor can it be implemented, as its provisions are vague and contradictory with each other. It's constantly being violated by high-ranking officials in the administration. Rather, the current administration itself is contrary to the Constitution. So the current Constitution, in its present version, is a major obstacle to peace. Now, I've read the 2004 Constitution, which was written, of course, by the U.S., and they give lip service to Islam. They claim that it's officially an Islamic country. But when the Taliban says it's contradictory, they're right. Because while it makes it an Islamic country, it also says that this government will follow the UN Declaration of Human Rights. This, of course, rejects any notion of a religious country, meaning that it has to be a secular liberal society, or at least at the state level. So it's contradictory. And that's kind of how so someone's reading this from there and they say, oh, there's an Islamic country and Islam is the central moral force. But then they say later on that no, the UN Declaration of Human Rights is the core of this constitution. And I don't have to tell you that the central bank is quote unquote independent of the state. Although I can't imagine profits are very high. The only thing that it's really good for is funneling aid money to the various factions. And of course, the major point, which has come up again and again, where, according to all estimates at the time, local, international, American, Russian, everybody, that the Taliban had destroyed poppy cultivation. They had reduced it to zero, and not just in terms of cultivation, but also the number of addicts have been reduced to almost nothing. But right after the U.S. invasion, and they're saying this at the conference, poppy cultivated land has reached 328,000 hectares, which is 811,000 acres, which is roughly 1,265 square miles. And of course, the number of addicts has increased to about 3 million people, which is very believable given the nature of the war. The UN Counter-Narcotics Organization says the production has increased by 87%, cultivation by 63% in 2017, which means that the narcotics has reached 9,000 metric tons. And as I said, the fatwa is very clear. It's execution for anybody, or certainly any member of their organization that has anything to do with heroin or any drug whatsoever. It's not uncommon, though, and it's a Johnson's Law thing, to hear that the Taliban are financed by drug money, which is laughable. Ted Galen Carpenter at the Cato Institute is one of the worst. Back in 2002, he made the claim, an unsighted claim, by the way, that somebody, not the government, somebody in Tajikistan says that heroin from Afghanistan was increasing. But he doesn't say what year that is. It could have been any time. And besides that, no one has any idea why heroin is going to Tajikistan. Now, of course, Carpenter and the Cato Institute, they're opponents in the war on drugs, such as it is. And they very much dislike the idea that any government can successfully carry one out. But the fatwa is still in effect. There's one thing we know about the Taliban is that their Islam is very strict. And execution is the punishment for anyone involved, even indirectly, with this. The Islamic Emirate has made it clear that quite often they have delayed or postponed military operations due to the risk of civilian casualties. They claim that the Americans and their friends carry out night raids on civilian houses, make blind bombardments, use heavy weapons in civilian places, etc. And numerous international entities, for better or for worse, has confirmed this. And the civilian casualty rate is one of the great scandals of this war. Now, since the Emirate is seeking popular support, it makes sense to contrast themselves with the behavior of the occupation forces in their interest. They have absolutely nothing to gain by risking civilian deaths, and yet the West has nothing to lose. The Taliban's strict Islam makes killing Muslims unnecessarily a severe crime, also punished by execution. That's why they condemned 9/11 the day it occurred. They condemned it, despite it having many strategic and military offices within the complex. They condemned it because innocent people were killed. And certainly they never thought that Osama had anything to do with it, since he was in Pakistan and a very, very sick man. Now, the U.S., as they're pulling out, the Taliban says this on their website. Meanwhile, the political tensions and squabbling inside the Kabul regime has pushed this crisis to another level. The resignation of Ashraf Ghani's national security advisor, Hanif Atmar, followed by the resignation letters of the Minister of the Interior, Defense, Chief of Intelligence, has exposed the deep schisms gripping the Kabul-based administration, speeding up the drivers behind its imminent collapse. The previous month saw a decision by American forces in compliance of their stooges to pull out all forces from rural areas of Afghanistan and focus on strengthening the defense of major cities in order to control the record number of casualties. The recent killings of one of the most important military commanders, Azula Karwan, as well as the killings of General Zalmay Wardak and two pilots inside Kabul city, clearly show that the enemy security measures have also failed, even inside cities, where they're unable to even prevent the assassinations of key figures. And these, of course, have been verified elsewhere. So clearly, the puppet government and Kabul, it can't stand even without the Taliban. They would have trouble functioning. Now, the surrender negotiations have to, of course, have to be done. The Americans can save face. So what they've been doing is, rather than directly pull men out, they're just not re-upping the tours over there. So it looks like that there's no actual retreat. They're just not, sending guys back. But that's not the only way they're doing it. Now, as far as the Kabul government is concerned, defections to the Taliban are massive and regular. And one reason certainly is the fear of later reprisals. There's no support of the population for this government. Local media have reported the discovery of wine and other whiskey in stores of some major cities, meaning that the Kabul government is actually selling alcohol, which, of course, is completely illegal, even if you don't consume it yourself. And this has become well known on the ground. So this government has absolutely no support. So now you have two kinds of intoxicants that's peddled by this government. Now, there's a new defense secretary, well, relatively new, and that's Mark Esper, was a military man at one point, a lieutenant colonel, and he said, and of course, you know, he's talking about these negotiations. They're not allowed to use the word surrender, and he, you know, he does some face saving of his own. The major press conference on these surrender negotiations, most of the time he just dodges questions. He says, for example, well, again, I don't want to get ahead of the State Department because they have the lead on this. But, you know, what the process was before, that there would be an agreement between the U.S. and the Taliban. In terms of the conditions moving forward, a principal condition, an early condition, would also be an agreement between the Taliban and the government of Afghanistan. So he uses a lot of words to not say anything. And at every question he would deflect by saying, well, we'll have the State Department handle that. And he really didn't want to talk about the surrender negotiation. In fact, he says in this one press conference that please let's talk about something else. Let's change the topic. And he actually says that. But for saying something so stupid that there has to be an agreement between the Taliban and the government, the U.S. public government in Kabul, proves that this guy doesn't know anything. The Taliban have said over and over again that they will never speak to those idiots. And the feeling is mutual. In fact, it's far harsher in the other direction. So it can't be a condition of any kind of withdrawal. One of the General Austin that I mentioned before, he said, and I'm quoting him here, he says, and then with regard to the withdrawal of forces, as we've always said, it'll be conditions-based, but we're confident that we can go down to 8,600 men without affecting our CT operations. And CT means counterterrorism. Now, I can't remember whether that was General Austin or Mark Esper. It doesn't make any difference because whoever it is, I think it was a general. He can't be that misinformed. He is well aware. Yes, it was General Austin. He was well aware that the comic army in Afghanistan couldn't fight and probably won't fight against the Emirates forces. Now, when they draw, I guess the target level is just around 8,000. They'll draw it down even lower than that. And they're not doing combat operations, generally speaking. They're mostly going to be involved in training. Now, the Emirates website says something very interesting, and I don't know if it's been reported in the U.S. yet. It may have been. They said, in the closing days of January 2017, an Israeli defense magazine revealed a provocative secret by publishing that Israeli drones are playing a crucial role under the emblem of NATO's Resolute Support mission inside Afghanistan by relentlessly killing innocent Afghan people on a daily basis. But with deeply embarrassing and humiliating discovery for the stooge heterogeneous setup, but they did not bother at least to clarify the situation, as they could not dare to react on this felony or aggression against their foreign masters. Now again, English is not their first language, unlike the ISIS nonsense where the English is perfect. There's been a few, Haaretz has reported, IUVM Press too has reported that the Israelis are already angling to make a profit over reconstruction. And some of them are even being nice, to the Taliban here. It's unlikely, because any talks with them would imply that they are the legitimate government of the state. And when the Taliban ruled Afghanistan, they had no diplomatic relations with Israel at all. But now you have an Israeli defense publication that their drones are being used to kill people in the last segment of the U.S. occupation, which is called Resolute Support. The Middle East Institute, which is, you know, very establishment corporate, they say this. They say, President Afram Ghani has yet to pass judgment on the pending accords. Of course, we're talking about the surrender negotiations. But many in Kabul insist that the Taliban have not changed their colors and cannot be trusted. They see the agreement as a surrender and betrayal by the Americans, and power installed in Islamic Emirate. There are disturbing indications that some Afghan power brokers are already exploring with the Taliban ways to secure their interests within a new regime. And that is what defeat looks like. The Middle East Institute, of course, is closely connected with the military and other things. The fact that power brokers, well, I don't know what he means by that exactly, are already playing nice with the Taliban, knowing they're going to have to live under them very soon. So this proves that the propaganda, of course, is just that, and that the Taliban are winning, they will soon take over, and that these are, in fact, surrender negotiations because the president has actually used the term, the president of Afghanistan, I mean. And at least they're honest in calling this thing a surrender. The conditions as it stands now, believe it or not, the Taliban have agreed not to attack U.S. troops as they flee the country. But they've also said that they will not cease fighting until the last foreign soldier is removed. I wouldn't want to be one of these 8,500 men that are left, because they would be a sitting duck. There's really nothing to gain, these guys being there. Of course, the U.S. will not leave entirely. But then, of course, as I predicted and several others predicted, ISIL shows up, or Daesh shows up in Afghanistan. And we all know what that means. As the U.S. pulls out, they have their proxy army moving in. The Taliban says this: in the beginning of April 2017, the chieftains of the Sinwari Tribal Council said that Daesh, or ISIL, is widely and openly supported by the puppet regime, that is to say, the American government in Kabul. This claim was reiterated by Zahir Kader and several other local officials, but no adequate or acceptable answer was given by the Stooge administration authorities. In the same month, the mother of all bombs was dropped by the savage American invading forces in the Akhon district of Nangarhar province, which had a widespread echo in the world media, although it wasn't as harmful as it was perceived to be. The American authorities widely propagated to pretend their seriousness about the issue of Daesh, but several analysts, including Karzai, declared that it was only the testing of American war technology and the soil of on soil of occupied Afghanistan was chosen as a testing ground. Now, again, English not their first language. That if you remember the mother of all bombs claim, a lot of propaganda. It didn't do much damage because it was a test. But by now, I think everyone that isn't being paid by the regime knows what ISIS is. And of course, as I predicted, the minute the U.S. leaves, ISIS moves in to act as their proxy forces. As the U.S. pulls out, ISIS will move in. And they're often using American transports and logistical equipment. And in fact, it would mean that the U.S. is dependent on their ISIS proxies. Last May 30th, two military vehicles carried five fighters, Daesh fighters, each equipped with sophisticated American weapons and special forces fatigues, were being tracked by both government agents and the Taliban. They got out, entered into two American vehicles, then passed through dozens of checkpoints without being questioned by anybody, till they stopped in front of the new building of the Interior Ministry of Afghanistan. 10 armed men got out of the vehicles, they were warmly received by the security, and then they shot them all. Now, ISIS took responsibility for the attack through its own media agency, though I'm not sure why that would automatically mean it's true. Now, CNN claimed that this group of guys blew up the gates on their way in and forced their way in, yet no eyewitnesses saw that. There'd be no way to gain access to the new Interior Ministry building without inside contacts. This is what happens when you have embedded journalists. Of course, all the attackers were killed. It was a suicide mission. They obviously knew security, got out of the car. They were warned, like this was a delegation from them. They were allies. And then they pulled guns on them and killed them all. Laughably, ISIS has large open-air training centers in Kabul under the watchful eye of both the regime and the USA. A year ago, the U.S. sent ISIS against the Taliban in Jalalabad, where, of course, the ISIS was defeated. Wherever there's war between the Mujahideen and Daesh, foreign and government forces will attack Taliban positions. Taliban forces have over and over again seized American vehicles full of ammunition and equipment bound for ISIS. And their POWs have confessed over and over again that these are, you know, they are arming and supporting this group. Last year, the Americans protected and rescued 250 Daesh personnel in Jawzan province that were under attack from the Taliban. And the Kabul administration admitted this, by the way. Americans conduct operations for the protection of ISIS, provide weapons and ammunition. They exaggerate their strength and numbers. It's the same thing in Syria. On January 13th of this year, 2019, the U.S. organized a prison break for ISIS or Daesh militants from a Taliban prison in northwest Afghanistan. The American Air Force bombed the Taliban positions around the prison and then sent their special forces via helicopter to rescue the 40 or so men inside. And video, I've seen the video of this, or not the video of the attack, but the transfer of Daesh fighters to the puppet government. And then about a year ago, in fighting in western Afghanistan between ISIS and the Taliban, the U.S. without fail attacked the Taliban positions. They do the exact same thing in Syria. And one of the most outrageous was back in September 2016 in Deir ez-Zor in Syria that came under ISIS attack. Now, the situation of the city was such that the Syrian army was dependent on airlifted supplies. So both British and American warplanes attacked those supply lines from the air and, of course, bombed exclusively Syrian army targets on the 17th. Now, immediately following that attack, ISIS fighters, in a coordinated action, attacked the Syrian forces that remained, and the city was overrun. Now, when the city was then recaptured, the ISIS fighters that remained were taken from the city by American transports in the so-called Raqqa deal. And it seems that the American cover stories, they get worse and worse. But even you have Talal Salo, who was a commander of the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces, sponsored by the Americans. He said roughly 4,000 ISIS fighters were bussed out of the city with their weapons. And this is the man who's paid by the U.S., says that American officials made the decision in consultation with the SDF, which contradicts the U.S. narrative that these anti-Assad Syrians forced it upon the Americans, as if that's even possible. So American backing for ISIS is so blatant. And Hillary Clinton, here's a woman who, when she was Secretary of State, she doesn't know anything about world politics. In a WikiLeaks release, she says, "While this military, paramilitary operation is moving forward in Syria, we need to use our diplomatic and more traditional intelligence assets to bring pressure on the governments of Qatar and Saudi Arabia, which are providing clandestine financial and logistical support to ISIL and also other radical Sunni groups in the region." And of course, the context of this is that the U.S. is in fact supporting these groups via these countries, among other things. And yet, the American media, the American academics will continually say, knowing all of this, that the U.S. is fighting ISIS. And I'm at a point now where this is a form of denial. I mean, I don't like making psychiatric, diagnoses from people I don't know personally. But given the huge amount of information that's out there, whether it be on 9/11 or ISIS, and especially some of the more ridiculous stories and the green screen, the bad videos and all that, as I've said before, for these people to believe the truth about 9/11, for these people to believe that ISIS is an American creation and has been backed by it, as it has to be, their whole worldview would come crashing down. And worse than that, if they're academics or journalists, they'll be called a conspiracy theorist, which is usually followed by anti-Semite, strangely enough. But that's how political analysis is done elite institutions. It's fear. Fear of these, this name calling, which isn't just name calling, it's the end of your career, or at least a very much, much harder career. And the Taliban have said over and over again, of course, they're defeating Daesh, ISIS with ease. And they've usually, you know, they've purged areas where ISIS has been airlifted by the U.S. But they say over and over again, in the Zawa area of the Kogani district, the USAF, as usual, comes to their rescue. Each battle shows the American Air Force attacking Taliban positions as they're fighting ISIS, without exception. And Russian military intelligence, both in Afghanistan and in Syria, have come right out and said that the ISIS Air Force is the U.S. That's what the troops are fighting for over there. August, from last August, 17th to 19th, drone strikes and two-man strikes on Taliban positions, which killed 13 Taliban, one civilian, was done in a battle against ISIS. The ISIS fighters are never attacked. Now, we know how bad American intelligence is, but it ain't that bad. And as the Taliban were preparing, they're going to launch an operation against the Daesh militia in the Lahore Dagh area of Manarwa district in Kumar province on August 18th, they came under attack from the USAF and drones. And as this is happening, the exposed ISIS fighters were picked up by Ranger pickups, American pickups, after American aerial bombardment. So there's simply no question anymore. And battles that the Taliban is fighting against these guys at critical periods of time, because ISIS is not doing well against the Taliban. The American Air Force is there to save them over and over again. And not just from the air. There have been mortar attacks, there have been missile strikes against the Taliban in support of ISIS. In Kogani district, not too long ago, they were in pursuit of ISIS fighters they had defeated. And of course, there was a massive mortar and missile strike against the Taliban forces to make sure that the ISIS fighters could escape. So, again, I was the first one to expose this from the very first picture I saw of these idiots in ISIS. I made fun of, that was the Charlie's Angels pose. Remember that picture that they had? I call the Charlie's Angels picture, where they're all in that dramatic formation, in perfectly clean, absolutely perfectly pressed black uniforms in the desert, which made me laugh. Not a speck of dust on them. Now, you see all these pictures with their prisoners in the orange jumpsuits. Why they're spending money on orange jumpsuits, I don't know. But you notice in all of these pictures, there is not a speck of sweat or dirt on any of these, which led me to make the claim that ISIS has the best laundry service of any guerrilla army in world history. I mean, my favorite fake picture, I think I've mentioned this before, you've probably seen it a long time ago. There's a picture of a guy standing in a hole in the desert somewhere, and he's holding a shovel. And an orange jumpsuit, of course, because they have to have standardized jumpsuits for their prisons, because that's what guerrilla groups do. And the caption said, I think this is in Time, the caption said, this is an Israeli prisoner who's forced to dig his own grave before ISIS shoots him. And I noted, and I was the only person of all the comments to note that there wasn't a drop of sweat on this guy. And of course, his uniform was perfectly pressed and clean. Not even a little bit of dirt on it. And again, I made the comment about the laundry service, which is apparently they spend a lot of money on. The fact that I was the only guy in something like, 400 comments to note this obvious fact. And I don't know if they responded to me or what. I'm banned from most of these, you know, pages anyway. But that no one noted that. And that's how bad the propaganda is. It's like they're seeing how much they can get away with. But that picture, of all the fake ISIS pictures, that one's my favorite. Now, if you are either the Americans that are going to be left behind after the surrender, or anyone working for the Afghan government as it stands now, why are you going to risk your life? I mean, the only reason, everyone who knows anything says that their guys are getting paid. A lot of the Afghan soldiers who were left, who haven't deserted, you know, really have no other options in life, which is why they're there in the first place. Morale doesn't exist either in the American or the Afghan side. And of course, needless to say, aid money goes nowhere. And this almost goes without saying. And this is again from the Taliban website. They say, in the meantime, surveys conducted by an international organ, which I think they mean the UN, revealed that the heterogeneous stooge regime, which is their odd phrase for the U.S. public government in Kabul, heterogeneous. I think they mean that there's too many factions that they're just kind of forced together. Anyway, revealed that the heterogeneous stooge regime is completely failed and inefficient, and Afghanistan is facing one of the highest famine ratio. I don't know what they mean there. Famine conditions, despite the huge amount of international funds provided over the years. John Sopko, the head of SIGAR, which is the name for the aid mission, announced the number of casualties of local mercenary armed forces have increased significantly, and the Stooge administration in Kabul and their American masters have agreed not to reveal their real number, and losses from now on. On the other side, the power supply company in Kabul said that the high-ranking Stooge officials owe nearly $10 billion, because local Afghans have not paid their electricity bills for years, and that includes the government. And that is a UN report. But no one's surprised by that. But in August, again, this is also from the Taliban, August of 2019, almost 1,000 government workers in Kabul joined their organization. In April alone, 700 deserted. Now, even the Americans have admitted that there is a huge desertion problem here. They can't count on the loyalty of even its workers in the capital city. And this is why it can't be called a government at any level. They can't control the majority of its territory. They can't control people working in its own offices. And the Taliban says in April of 2017, again, this is also verified elsewhere, and they're making fun of this heterogeneous government, this constantly bickering people who were just brought together because the U.S. said so. The so-called president, Ashraf Ghani, is openly mocked and challenged by the chief executive, Abdullah Abdullah. Parliament members openly oppose the executive branch and consider it illegitimate. The executive contemptuously disregards parliament and refuses to recognize its legislative authority. General Dotson and Adanur proudly throw insults at each other in the media. Ahmad Massoud refuses to accept Ghani's directives, removing him from his post. Each party is developing parallel links with foreign powers to strengthen their hold on power. So really, it's almost a sad sight that even with American support, this government can't function. They don't even believe, when you have the legislative power claiming that the presidency is illegitimate, even their own government doesn't claim that they thinks they're illegitimate. That even their own people say that we don't belong here. And even when that 10-ton MOAB bomb in the Nangarhar province, mother of all bombs, that nonsense, which was, a war crime, Ghani, the president, welcomed it. And yet his ambassador in Pakistan and close advisor, Omar Zakilwal, declared it a war crime and a disgrace. So the administration doesn't agree even on that. So even when the U.S. does actions in their interest, half the government condemns it. And so this is where your tax money is going if you're an American. All of the reconstruction funds have been misspent. The so-called Ring Road which is a big highway that connects all of the major cities. Now, and the U.S. attempted to rebuild this at one point. But the U.S. is too overstretched. They can't maintain it. And since the Taliban had retaken most of the country by 2008, the government can't maintain it. And so that ring road, which was supposed to be their trade artery, now doesn't exist. Now, certainly the Taliban will rebuild it when they take over again. They're not going to rebuild it to support the trade that as it exists under the Americans. But this is all done with private funds via the American taxpayer. But the American consulting group that built the roads and all of the, not just the ring road, but all the highways have abandoned their projects because it needs armies of men to maintain it. Even after $3 billion was spent on the ring, it still remains incomplete and a wreck today. But the very fact that Taliban control most of the country without help from anybody, I mean, it can see a little bit from Pakistan, possibly. But even there, that's questionable. Shows their legitimate popularity. Now, I don't have time to get into the so-called dancing boys. You know the scandal with the Afghan National Army keeping little boys as sex slaves. We don't have time for that. Just suffice it to say that officials in the Afghan government openly defend that practice. There's a major in the Marine Corps, William Stubert, who was one of the advisors to the ANA, said that if you were to take away their criminal schemes, you would render the government totally ineffective. And he's completely demoralized. And one of the reasons that he's demoralized, and I mentioned him because he was in one of the documentaries, is because of the child rape that the government in Afghanistan engages in. That they're kidnapped and kept as slaves, by ANA officials. He also said that it was rare that ANA soldiers were not either stoned or on some other drug. And usually local police are Taliban soldiers in disguise. So, all told, this is a picture of miserable failure. The Taliban is a nationalist force. They say over and over again, we want nothing to do with any other country. We want to be relatively isolated. We don't threaten anybody. We want to rebuild Afghanistan. This is why they're enemies with Al-Qaeda, because Al-Qaeda wants this, global or semi-global revolution, which the Taliban condemn. They say we are going to function in Afghanistan and only in Afghanistan. This is not an international fight in their mind. But a strict organization like the Taliban is exactly what's needed to rebuild this country, both economically and morally. Ethical thinking is destroyed after this. They destroyed the drug trade. Once they could do it again. But this is central because the massive crisis, opiate addiction, exists because of the American invasion of Afghanistan and the removal of the Taliban. The numbers of opiate addict or heroin addicts or pain pills, whatever, in the West is directly correlated with the massive amount of the drugs that is coming out of Afghanistan. Precisely correlated. So this is extremely important to our domestic political situation. The Taliban taking power will cut off a major source of this. And hopefully that will drive up the price enough to get a lot of people off of it. Anyway, thank you for listening, everyone. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.